I had like a really crappy car with nothing in it, but someone had shattered the window. I was like, why would anyone do that? And then I tried to start it. And I was like, oh, shit.
Oh.
So they shattered the window to pop the trunk in order to get the battery.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah.
That's Car Talk with 538.
Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. It is a new week, and if anyone is relieved, it might be the folks at the White House. Last week was quite a whirlwind in terms of both staffing and policy. Hope Hicks is out. Trump spent some time skewering Jeff Sessions. Jared Kushner's security clearance got downgraded. And as far as policy went, Trump bucked the NRA on guns for at least a day and then sort of went back and forth on guns, and then he started talking about how trade wars are easy to win. So there's a lot to talk about, and today we're going to focus on what that last week tells us about the White House's decision-making and the sort of way that they do statecraft. So here to have that conversation is politics writer Claire Malone. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
Politics editor Micah Cohen, to my right. Hello, Micah.
Hello.
And on the phone is politics writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hi, Perry.
Hi, guys.
And Nate is... We don't know where Nate is. He's traveling around this week.
I know where he is.
Okay, only Micah knows where he is. We'll see. I didn't mean it to be that mysterious. Nate's out this week. And later on, we're also going to talk about these newly released presidential rankings. We just published a piece this morning kind of looking at whether it's worthwhile to rank presidents and kind of some of the pitfalls of that, and particularly ranking current presidents. Before we do any of that, though, let's ask a question we like to ask from time to time. Good use of polling or bad use of polling? Our example this week comes from the early voting numbers in the Texas midterm primary. There's been a lot of headlines around this. I'm going to read one from NPR as a representative sample. It says, quote, Democrats see possible blue wave in Texas primary early voting. That's like a 538, like, cautionary buzzword, like jumble right there. Blue wave, early voting, possible. But nevertheless, let's talk about it. The numbers have shown that Democratic turnout in Texas topped GOP turnout after 8 days of early voting from February 20th to February 27th. It has already exceeded levels of Democratic primary turnout in 2016 and nearly doubled early turnout from the 2014 midterms. Micah, I'm sure your Twitter feed and just kind of like the political world has you've seen this a lot. What do you make of this all this buzz about the early turnout in Texas?
I don't make anything
really.
People love talking about Texas.
It's like people love talking about Texas and early voting for whatever reason. People love early voting. In 2016, we saw this too. People just like grasp onto early voting as a thing. And look, it's not a thing. It's like, don't read into early voting. I feel like
it's flax. Feed this to people and they're like, the early voting numbers are looking really good for our side. And then people like have to write a story. And so they're like, well, I'll write a story about the early voting.
It does sound very convincing, right? It's like, oh.
Let me repeat that just because it is kind of startling. Turnout for Democrats has already doubled turnout from 2014.
Okay, so like,
well, at some point, if there's going to be a massive wave, you're going to get the first sign of it. And so the question is always, what is the legit first sign of it? And maybe this is it. And I will also just add that, you know, Dave Wasserman, who's a colleague of ours who we tend to like, who tends to be very cautious, I've noticed on his Twitter feed, he's sort of dipping some toes into saying this might be for real. I don't know if you kind of think Dave's getting out over his skis there. I don't know.
I might be wrong, but I don't think he was talking about early voting. I think he was talking about giving a better chance to Beto O'Rourke in Texas than he usually would. I think that's if I remember seeing that on Dave's feed. I don't remember seeing him say anything about early voting. But I do think Dave's point is, look, you know, everyone, it's a longstanding joke for those listeners who are not in on it that like, whoop, the Democrats are going to turn Texas blue this time. And it's like, you know, it's become sort of this almost like the perpetual infrastructure week joke. Except it's been going on for like 10 years.
That's not a joke.
It's a joke for Claire.
That's a Claire joke. Yeah.
But basically, a lot of people think that that's hogwash. But Dave was trying to say, actually, this potential blue wave or demi wave, whatever we decided to call it a while back, you know, it could affect Texas and it could make races in Texas tighter. But I don't think he was talking about early voting. I think he was talking about the race overall.
I saw this great tweet, which was written on March 4th, saying, anyone have any statistical proof that turnout in Texas primaries actually matters for November, or tell us anything beyond what we already know? DM slated to do well. I'm genuinely curious. It was funny, only because this person has it in his Twitter feed, he calls himself the forecaster. So people immediately were like, are you the forecaster? Don't you know the answer to this question? And I think the answer is Harry doesn't know. I don't know. And I think Mike is right. We don't really know much from these early numbers to tell us anything. But everyone thinks Texas is going to turn bluer, or maybe the Democrats win a few more House races in Texas. So I think that's reasonable to think. It's not based on these early numbers. I think it's more based on the polls that show Beto pretty close and Trump doing poorly in the suburbs around Houston.
Yeah, that's key. So let's put some fine points on this. One, don't read into early voting. It just hasn't been around long enough for us to reliably say what it means. So Democratic turnout is doubled what it was in 2014. We don't know if that's a meaningful signal because it just hasn't, early voting hasn't been around long enough. The other point, what Perry just said, is really important, which is we already had signs that the Democrats were going to do really well in 2018. Special elections, the generic ballot, all types of other, you know, Trump's approval rating. So in the sense that this points in the same direction, maybe I'll pay a little more attention to it. But like, everybody freaked out about early voting in 2016, and with the exception of Nevada, they were basically wrong across the board. The other, just one more thing is, Harry actually looked at how much in presidential elections the primary vote predicts the general election vote, and the answer is it doesn't really, you know. So this is just, it's not a use of polling, but people need to stop doing this.
Or actually, it's not a use of polling, which is kind of our point, that there are polls out there. We tend to say wait for the polls, wait for the good polls, wait for there to be a sort of critical mass of polls, and that's still a few months away, right? I mean, we're really, it's early.
Yeah, and if you want to think of the early vote as a form of a poll, sure, but then you really, you don't have enough polls, basically.
Right, that's a good point. Okay, so let's leave it there, and we're going to move on and get on to our first segment. But first, let me ask you a brief question. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and praying for the right people to use it. Well, ZipRecruiter has revolutionized that practice. Their hiring technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/538. You don't have to spell it out like you do on our website, just the numbers, 538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. They were able to get the
just
URL.
Just the numbers, jeez.
We weren't even able to get that. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, let's get into our first segment, which is a look at turnover in the Trump White House as departures of notable aides continue. And I think we should talk about this less as the sort of palace intrigue stuff and more as a way to think about Trump's inner circle, the people advising him, and what it says about decision-making around important issues in the Trump White House. So Trump's been president for, 13 months now or so? There's been enough turnover, as it happens, to maybe have a little data, build a little data set. So, Micah, let's look at the numbers. How do those stack up? How does turnover in the Trump White House compare to previous White Houses?
It's higher.
Okay. Thanks.
Good top line.
You know, you can look at a lot of different things. So let's start at the top. If you look at, like, Trump's cabinet, I think he's had, Perry, is it three or four cabinet level departures so far?
Tom Price at HHS. I'm trying to think of other cabinet. The chief of staff is a cabinet level person.
Priebus, Price.
Priebus.
Oh, and I guess Kelly technically counts because he left home. In any case, if you look at all recent administrations, pretty much none of them had anybody in their cabinet or cabinet level official leave in the first year. Trump, depending on how you count, has had a handful, right? Then you look at just, you know, widen that out to sort of just general high profile staff. And it just feels like maybe every other week there's somebody leaving, right? So, you know, it's a little squishy in terms of the exact numbers, but, you know, you can look at individual positions. Quartz had this great graphic of Trump's communication chiefs and how long they served compared to Obama's. And Obama actually had his first two, Ellen Moran and Anita Dunn, served 92 days and 224 days respectively, you know, and then you had people serve, you know, a year, 2 years, et cetera. Here's Trump's. Sean Spicer, 46 days. Mike Dubke, 86 days. Sean Spicer, take two, 53 days. Scaramucci, 11 days. Hope Hicks, 197 days. So that's an average of 78.6 days per.
Legit forgotten about Mike Dubke.
Me
like that was a
too.
Name that was just not in my brain before the instant before you read it out loud. So I think this is a scenario where, like, listeners, if you are feeling like there's a lot of turnover, yes, there's a lot of turnover.
The numbers back
that up.
Yeah.
We can trust that. So let's talk about what the actual effect of that is. Our colleagues Amelia and Andrea recently wrote a piece that I think came out last week that was sort of like a rubric for evaluating these departures and sort of asking a question that I'll pose to you, Claire, which is, does every time there's a departure, is it necessarily a sign of trouble or could it mean something else?
Yeah. In their piece, they talked a bit about what departures mean, usually in sort of business structures. And they were making the point that the federal government, a lot of agencies expect senior officials to leave. But I think the Trump scenario is different because in many cases, it seems like the high-level departures come not just with, okay, this is turnover, but there haven't perhaps been a lot of projects implemented. You could look at a place like the State Department where, yes, Rex Tillerson is purposely starving some parts of the State Department, but in other ways, he's not really making a lot of moves there. There's a certain sense of, in the Trump White House, the Trump administration, there's perhaps enough turnover that it doesn't just affect the siloed out portions that person who was running something has now left. It affects the general tenor, office morale, and cohesiveness when it comes to what is the agenda of President Trump and his administration. What are they trying to accomplish? In a lot of ways, I think we're seeing in some ways, maybe because of all these departures, that congressional leaders have a whole lot of power nowadays. And I'm not saying it's the end of the imperial presidency, but I will say that it's certainly a lot of the lack of clear vision does give members of Congress, particularly Republicans, a lot more leeway and power to push up against the executive, mm-hmm. which you have not seen a lot in recent years and decades.
So I definitely want to get us to that. But staying on the White House itself, Perry, you know, I feel like this Michael Wolff book that came out a couple months ago gave us a little bit of a sense of how decision making took place within the White House. Now, every time there's a departure, we kind of like get a little bit more of a sense of the taxonomy and all the different roles. So can you paint a picture of like how decisions get made within a White House now if ultimately it is about sort of this as an operational, vehicle?
Well, it would depend so much on what the decision is. I mean, from a speech to a chair. I mean, I guess the thing I would say about this particular departure we saw last week is that I think Micah was referring to it. I think Obama had 5 communications directors in 8 years. Hope Hicks' replacement will be Trump's 5th. Her departure was not as surprising to me in that a lot of people who worked on Obama's campaign for those 2 years and then worked at the White House for 2 years, they had done sort of 4 years in Obama world and they moved on. That seems like so Hope left in 3 years, but my guess is 3 years in Trump world is equivalent to 4 or maybe 8 years of Obama world. So that was not necessarily that surprising to me. I mean, the communication director for Trump, I'm not totally sure. You know, I think he directs communications. I'm not sure how much influence she had. I mean, part of the story here with Hope Hicks was that Trump has this very weird way of dealing with reporters where he has a communications department, but if you knew Hope Hicks well and you talked to Hope Hicks and said, hey, I want to talk to Trump, she gets on the phone with Trump pretty quickly. So a lot of reporters are sort of invested in her as someone who is helpful to them in a certain way, and I think that's important. But in terms of like whether how Trump tweets, which is a big part of his communications, I'm not sure that that'll change a lot with Hope Hicks moving on.
Yeah, this is a really interesting thing. And I think part of the reason that we are more, or I don't know if this is true, it feels like the media, including us, are more focused on the staffing in Trump's White House than we have been in past administrations, because Trump is so unpredictable and his thinking is such a black box in a lot of ways. It's actually the opposite of a black box. It's like his thinking is so transparent that it ends up being somewhat inscrutable, right? But like we end up, you know, Perry and I talked a lot right after inauguration, and Perry, I think we kind of had the assumption, which I think has been right, that because Trump was so inexperienced and had such unformed policy positions, that his staffing would be more important than for past administrations. Is that?
I still think that's true.
I think that's true.
I mean, like a Scott Pruitt has more power than I would argue the average EPA person, because I'm not sure Trump has any views on the EPA that are, you know, particularly relevant.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think that there are sort of 2 levels to staffing in the Trump administration. One, there are these intellectual centers, so the Scott Pruitts, the Sessions, the Mick Mulvaneys of Trump world. And those are the people that has, you know, going back to my point about people grabbing more power now that there's not a president with sort of the strong vision per se. So there are those people, the intellectual centers, those are, you know, those exist and those are important because they want to pull Trump in different ideological ways. And then I think due to the president's mercurial temperament and his sort of capricious way of doing business, there are the people that are sort of the stabilizing staff members. And I think those people are, you know, Kushner mm-hmm. to some extent because he's family, but who knows
yeah,
right now.
Yeah.
But I think Hicks was emblematic of that. You know, the idea that Trump is a particular, peculiar kind of person who needs these people to basically be like his gravity blanket. Are you mm-hmm. guys familiar with the concept of a gravity blanket? I just learned about it this weekend.
Really? Oh, a weighted blanket?
That's wonderful.
A gravity blanket is like a weighted blanket that's like constantly, when you put it on, it's like someone giving you a constant hug and it makes you
aww.
Calm down.
It's very relaxing.
So I kind of think Trump needs a certain...
A hug.
Jared Kushner is Trump's
gravity blanket. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But so let me ask you though, because I think the Kushner thing, to your point, is really interesting in that I think regardless of whether you know like Trump or not, stabilizing forces are good inside a White House. Does the loss of Hicks and then Kushner now losing his security clearance, maybe being on the outs, but also just kind of like having less information about really important decisions, should that be worrisome? How much of that gravity blanket is left for Donald Trump?
Well, I think that as we see, so the Post had an article, what was it, Micah, you linked to this, yesterday, today, sometime mm-hmm. in the last couple of days, that talked about Trump's mood was terrible last week, and as the Post reports, that's the reason why, you know, he went out and started the the trade war.
Mm-hmm.
He went a lot of different directions on guns because no one was there kind of whispering in his ear, okay, take it easy on this or that. So if you believe the Post reporting on that, which, you know, they say that they talked to 22 people with knowledge of the situation, that Trump was in sort of an erratic mood last week. So maybe.
No, so yeah, maybe. But this is where I think.
I just like the idea of acting out through a trade war.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, that might be what's happening. But this is, I mean, Perry should speak to this more than me. But this is where I think staffing stories get into trouble. So I'm all for like, okay, Hope Hicks leaves. How do we think that will affect White House decision making? Mm-hmm. Right. But how many times during this administration have we read a story that's like the mood in the White House is at a nadir? And
I was actually thinking that as I was reading it. I was like, how many ways have they written
but
this
I just lead? Don't right. I just don't know if those are different questions, particularly in this White House, because we've seen that the line between Trump's mood and his decision making is not as long as it is and not as attenuated as it is for a lot of other presidents.
I guess what I'd say is I'd draw a distinction between policy and behavior. So yeah. I think Claire's totally right that on policy, Trump leaves vacuums that other people fill, whether it's Mulvaney or Pruitt or whoever, right? On behavior, this idea that like Hope Hicks or Kushner or Ivanka, wherever or have ever been stabilizing forces, I'm just not sure what the evidence is for that. I mean, they've mm-hmm. been with him since the beginning, and since the beginning, Trump has been all over the place. So, like, I don't, you know, yeah. I just don't know where that comes from.
This idea that even the, I, you know, I respect people's posts, but Trump has been talking about tariffs and changing tariff policy for
right.
decades. So the idea that he may have done the actual policy in an erratic way this week, but he's been wanting to impose tariffs the entire time he's been president, and the staff has been trying to stop him and stop him from doing what he wants to do, and he finally got it done. But I think that was going to happen at some point anyway. So I'm never sure. His mood is up and down. I'm not sure I really analyze yeah. or care. Like the gun thing, you know, he said some things on guns that I don't think are going to happen in law, and I think Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan are going to politely, you know, shoot those things down. Like, the people I would be worried if, you know, look at who they left in a big way is General Mattis. If he left, because he runs a big department that can yeah. start a war, and he's actually a stabilizing force, is my understanding on Trump's instincts about North Korea and so on. That's the kind of, if Hope Hicks is, you know, was moderating Trump in the campaign, I'm not sure how effective she was. This is Michael was getting at versus any administration, the foreign policy has had lots of bluster, but actually most of the time pretty normal actual policy. And those are the people like McMaster, Mattis, Kelly to some extent. If one of those guys leaves, they're the gap between Trump and nuclear war. So that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I think in the Post article they were linking like, well, Mnuchin had been telling people, listen, I've been putting Trump off this tariffs thing, so he keeps on talking about And they sort of seem to be linking, like, well, you know, why this week of all the weeks in the world did he decide to go off on it? And maybe there was some sort of, I don't know. You're right, Perry. It's a total, like, and Micah, you guys are right. It's like, they're weird stories when you pull back. Like, yeah. If we read this 3 years ago,
we'd be like, oh my God.
Like, what?
But I guess that's my question. So in the last days of Nixon's administration, there's reporting that suggests, like, he was drinking super heavily, mm-hmm. not sleeping, perhaps taking medication, and was just pretty unhinged, right?
And isolated.
And I think we'd want, as an American public, we'd want to know if that were happening, right? But do you guys think there's value? I mean, I do feel like I've read this story, even from the Post. I love the Post, but, like, do you think there's value in these stories that try to capture the mood or that, you know, connect these dots in this way?
I hate to say this about someone's reporting because I think it's real reporting, but I do think it's a little bit feeding the people what they want.
Yeah.
I tend to think they are kind of clicky lines of.
But it's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence we see them in times of crisis. I mean, I remember in the run-up to the Iraq War, there was a lot of sort of, you know, what is Cheney's influence? What is Rumsfeld's influence? Even, like, nitty-gritty stuff of, like, what's in the presidential daily briefings.
Does anyone besides the people on this podcast and a few selective, like, other D.C. journalists read those stories?
It's also, I think it's different, Jody, than trying to suss out to what extent Cheney is influencing the Iraq plan. Like, that kind of reporting, I think, is hard. But is, like, you're trying to get a hold of something pretty concrete. What is Cheney doing, mm-hmm. yeah. right? As opposed to, look, Perry, you've reported on it. I've never reported on a White House. Perry, like, if I said to you, I want you to write me a story about the mood in the White House, how would you go about reporting that out?
I mean, you would talk to a lot of staffers. You start with the junior staffers and go up the chain. I mean, I guess it's a question about the mood according to who and how.
Right.
I mean, the mood of the president and the mood of the White House are slightly different things, I think. And, like, I guess Claire was saying, I feel like I've read several versions of in the Times and the Post, and I respect those people a lot, of the sort of Trump is unhinged, Trump is really mad. Like, the Nixon stories were building up towards something. I feel like I read a lot of Trump is unhinged and he's mad. And his Twitter feed sort of tells me that to some extent, so I'm not sure the reporting is necessarily tell me, I guess if there were incidents of Trump, like, threw something into a wall or he, like, cussed out Kelly, or there are maybe some details that would be helpful, but I'm not really getting much more than Trump is mad, and I sort of think I know that already.
Right. And again, I mean, I think we all agree that this is most useful when it's in the service of understanding how actual decisions get made and how actual policy kind of rolls out, not just the who's mad at who.
But I totally agree with that, and it speaks to how tough these types of stories are, because, like, take tariffs. So Trump announces these tariffs, right? Nothing's actually been done yet, as far as I can tell.
No, and I don't think, I mean, I never expected anything to happen.
No, right, Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, was on the Sunday shows and was like, you know, Chuck Todd was like, well, when is this going to, this is going to happen this week? And Wilbur Ross is like, well.
Do you know what my post headline for that would be? No tariffs for old man.
And there's reporting today that Paul Ryan is now sort of breaking with this and Congress is breaking away. So I think maybe actually this gets back to something that Claire said in at the very beginning, which is what does the instability and maybe the sort of, like, hollowing out circle around Trump, does it tell us anything about his relationship to the rest of government and the larger GOP? And is this going to continue to be a sort of widening gulf?
I think of this as the fact that the Kushner and Ivanka and Hope and all these people who are close to Trump, but not necessarily Republicans, what I think it tells us is that that sort of group of the people is not that powerful. This is like, I mean, I guess it's hard for me. We've spent a lot of time in the media writing about Ivanka and Jared and how interesting they are and they have power. It's hard for me to point to a single decision that they've made that was broke from any that really made a difference. Like, I mean, if you ask me who has more power in the White House, Mike Pence or Ivanka Trump, in terms of policy, this is much more of a Mike Pence agenda than a Ivanka Trump one, whatever her agenda is. It's just hard for me. To me, it's like, What I only thing I see is that the, you know, like Kushner's spokesman left last week. It seems to me that group of people who were sort of thought to maybe be, I mean, I guess, I, you know, Claire might be right that they might be moderating Trump's behavior, but in terms of like moderating Trump's agenda, they're not doing anything at all. And to some extent, my guess is they're leaving because they don't have any power.
Right. So to go back to my, the two spheres of people around Trump. So yeah, there's the people who are moderating his behavior or modulating his behavior. But then I think, Jody, to your larger question of like, what does it all mean? I do continue to think that it means you see that the conservative ideas that people really were workshopping in Congress, in the Freedom Caucus, you know, whatever, those things are given more heft and throughout the next couple of years, no matter what I think happens in the Congress, people will still be trying to push those ideas through to Trump, and he, you know, he'll take some of them. He might like talk a little bit out of turn about others of them, but at this point, you know, if he talks out of turn about a conservative policy, members of Congress feel sort of fully free to say, like, well, he doesn't really know what he's talking about, which they did, by the way, after that NRA meeting, which is pretty astounding. Like,
and on tariffs.
You saw Republican members of Congress go out and basically say to reporters, well, you guys know that he's not like, or, you know, that was pretty wild or something like that. And that's interesting.
But this gets at your earlier point, which is about the kind of how the balance of power has shifted a little bit towards Congress. You know, I don't know what's going to happen on tariffs or guns, but if Paul Ryan is coming out hard against tariffs, I think I'd put my money on no tariffs, right? You know, it's like, if we've learned anything so far in Trump's administration, it's that the better bet is usually on conservative orthodoxy. So
yeah, and I'll just add that I think this is going to be something for us to keep our eye on sort of through the election, both as the Mueller stuff heats up and then we'll see how the cookie starts to crumble with the midterm elections. But this notion of the Trump White House getting more and more isolated.
But I don't
know. That was not really my point, Claire. It wasn't, the cookie was a metaphor, but I understand that it is around lunchtime.
I did have cookies.
I mean, I hate to be too cynical about this, but I think, and I think our data would show this too, is that a lot of the sort of stories about the Trump inner circle are well read by readers. There's a great amount of, I do meet people, there's a great amount of curiosity about the sort of palace stuff. And that is not really the policy. Like, I don't know that Hope Hicks is writing our Iran policy, but she's colorful. I think people think she's pretty. I think there's a certain amount of interest in her that I think isn't necessarily that related. It's more interesting to write about Hope Hicks probably than write about Scott Pruitt. And I do think that's created a sort of interest in the media about, I think we're overdoing some of these White House intrigue stories because they're fun, and I think that creates more attention around it than I think is necessarily justified. And I do worry that that kind of, we're in sort of year two of the White House in chaos, and sometimes the White House in chaos really does tell us something, but sometimes people just leave the White House and they're tired of it, but it's like interesting to write about people who are sort of colorful personalities, and it becomes like, you know, some of the networks were like doing these big updates about Hope Hicks is leaving the White House. I mean, it was like, what is going on here? It's not that important.
And sometimes people leave the White House and it's good for the White House and Trump's agenda. I think it was probably helpful to Trump when Priebus left. I think it was probably helped when Bannon left. Exactly. So it's.
Do you know what we haven't talked about though? Hope Hicks's testimony, and like I just think
why she left.
You know, so Hope Hicks testified in front of the Congressional Committee and basically invoked executive privilege and said she wouldn't talk about a lot of this stuff. Now I think a lot of people say the executive privilege defense won't hold up for long, and that Hicks might be a very central part of the Mueller investigation should it come out that she was sending certain communications, whatever, hiding certain communications, whatever it might be. That, I think, is sort of like the big thing that I sort of read into with the Hope Hicks departure. So she left, yes, she left her post, or she renounced that she would be resigning in the coming weeks, the day after she made that testimony.
Gotcha. Okay, let's leave it there, and we will here say goodbye to Perry Bacon Jr. Thanks for joining us, as always.
All right, thanks for having me, guys.
And up next, we'll talk about presidential rankings. This week's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring, posting your position to job sites, and waiting and waiting and waiting for the right people to see it? Well, ZipRecruiter is here to say that there is a smarter way with the platform that they built that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you receive so you never miss a great match. This, by the way, is the biggest fear of anyone who's hiring, is that there's a diamond out there in the rough that they're going to miss. This solves that situation. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. Right now, listeners, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This week's podcast is also brought to you by WordPress. You've mastered your field. You've grown your business. Perhaps you've hired a great staff and you're ready to share your expertise. You know that you can deliver. Now you have to tell your audience. Make it easy to stand out, reach new customers, and build your credibility online when you build your website on WordPress.com. You don't need experience with code or design. WordPress.com provides all the tools you need to get your site up and running. Their customer support team is there to help 24/7. That's Monday through Friday and on the weekends. That's the 24 and the 7. Monday through Friday and on the weekends. They have e-commerce site options ranging from a simple and effective buy button to a complete online store. Plans start at just $4 a month and include a custom domain so you can get your site name exactly the way you want it. Nearly 30% of all websites run on WordPress. Build your brand online with the same tools that some of the world's biggest companies and publishers use to power their sites. Use WordPress. Start building your website today. Go to wordpress.com/politics for 15% off any new plan purchase. Again, that's wordpress.com/politics, wordpress.com/politics. All right, we're back, and we're going to discuss the pros and cons of ranking the presidents. But a quick word, listeners, I want you to cast your mind back a couple weeks ago when America was gripped by Olympic fever, not just Olympic fever, but curling fever. And you may remember that on this podcast, probably jokingly, Nate, just in a cast-off comment, said, we're going to do a curling podcast. And I kind of made a joke about it, and then there were a couple tweets about it. The internet kind of wanted it to happen. Well, as it happens, apparently, we're not joking, because last Friday, the U.S. men's champion curling team, the gold medal winners, visited the 538 offices, recorded a special podcast, which is now in the feed of our NBA podcast, The Lab. So again, this is the host of a politics podcast telling you about a curling podcast special, which is available in a basketball podcast feed. But really, it's fun. We've tacked a couple of minutes of it onto the end of this episode, so if you just keep listening after the credits, you'll be able to hear it. And also, I don't know if you guys saw this, but if you go on Twitter and poke around, there's a photo floating around with three of our colleagues, Galen, Tony, and Neil, wearing gold medals.
It's pretty cool.
Have you seen
this? Oh, that's super cool. I didn't see that. It's amazing.
So the curling team was here. They recorded. They brought the gold medals, and they let these guys wear them.
I saw it Friday night, and I wish I had been in the office.
I know. I was exactly the same thought. I was not in on Friday either. So I could have worn a gold medal.
I was going to say, if you ever wondered how much power I have in this newsroom, not much is the answer. And the curling podcast is proof of that. I was going to say that, but that
meaning
gold medal
that it happened?
That it happened. Yeah.
Same here. As ostensible podcast producer, I was like, oh, we're joking. Then this morning, and then like, here's the curling podcast.
But that sounded super cool, actually.
Yeah. Anyway, so stick around, keep listening. You'll hear some of it, and then go find it in the feed of The Lab. Okay, let's move on, and let's spend some time talking about presidential greats and not so greats. So two professors, Brandon Rodinghouse, who's been on this show before. Brandon Rodinghouse, that name
friend
rings
of the show.
Yeah, friend, is that right? He's been on once.
In German, does that mean literally rotting house?
Do you speak German?
Rottinghouse.
Very impressive.
That's good.
He was our scandal expert. And Justin Vaughn, another professor who I've never heard of until I just read his name. Anyway, they surveyed presidential experts to determine each president's place in history. They last did this survey in 2014, and some of the changes since then are telling. And of course, this is also a first look at Trump's place in history. So here to talk about those rankings and just in general whether these kinds of rankings are useful is 538 contributor and political science professor at Marquette University, Julia Azari. Hey, Julia, welcome back. It's been a while, so nice to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, James Buchanan.
Go.
That's how I start every interview.
That's our problem.
He oversaw our path to the Civil War. He was dislodged by one Donald J. Trump as the worst president in history in these rankings. This is a survey of presidential scholars. What do you make of that?
Well, so the first thing I make of that is I thought it was very interesting, the reaction that this survey got. So Brandon and Justin did this survey first in 2014.
First name basis, by the way.
And yeah,
I actually read papers with the band.
Yeah.
The poli-sci world is so small. Everybody knows each other.
That's basically it. There's just not that many of us that are this nerdy. So they did the survey in 2014. Obviously, Trump was not on it. Whatever, Buchanan was last. Then they did this in 2018, and there was this huge outcry of why would you survey a sitting president, and it's only been a year. And I thought that was sort of interesting from kind of how do we think about this stuff perspective. And here's my take about that based on some of the logic of the piece I had this morning, is that there's a lot of perspective you obviously lose from not knowing what happens later. Like, you obviously can't know what the rest of the presidency is going to be like or who the successor will be, which kind of tells you what the impact of the party was, the impact on the party. But what you do know is you have a kind of sense of what were the problems that that president was trying to solve, and how is that president meeting them in the moment. And I think that's some of what gets lost in history, is this sort of varied context. And so we create an interesting record. If we say, all right, a year in, scholars really thought that Trump was not rising to the occasion of the problems that we were facing in 2017 or what have you.
So do you feel like there is a sweet spot for evaluating how a president did? Is it an ever-evolving thing, or is it, you know, when do we have a best sense of sort of a president's success or failure?
I've been thinking a lot about this, and I think, like, there's not a good answer to that question, and here's why. I have a really unsatisfying answer to this question, but I think it's incorrect.
17.5 years after the end of their second term.
Oh, good. Great. Thank you. That's the kind of answer I'm looking for.
I was not told there was going to be math on this. So I think what happens over time is we get sort of solidified into our set of assumptions about what a president did and didn't do. And then we get in this dynamic, which we've seen over the last decade or so, where there's been all these books that come out about different presidents. Polk had, like, this sort of moment in the sun where about his impact on politics, and now Grant is kind of having this. And we have these biographers like Ron Chernow, who wrote the Hamilton biography that made non-president Hamilton so exciting, but now he's written a book about Grant. That kind of thing happens, and that can kind of change how we see a president. But otherwise, these same assumptions get entrenched. So as we get more perspective on what the long-term impact was, we kind of, like, lose. I think, I don't know why this is, but even presidency experts, I think, lose the capacity to think critically about elements that we've not previously incorporated into our scholarly rankings. So this was my big point in the piece about race. Like, it never enters into the discussion. Like, how do we think about Jefferson and Washington?
Yeah, can I ask about that, Julia? Because in some ways, it's a really interesting discussion about, it's historiography, right? It's how we evaluate, like, the history of presidents. Because in some ways, is it unfair for us to evaluate Jefferson on our 2018 field of morality? I mean, you know, there is a certain, you can make the argument that, like, well, it was different because, you know, half of the country owned slaves. And so even though half of the country maybe thought Jefferson was, you know, morally bankrupt, although I don't think that whole half of the country that didn't own slaves there weren't rabid racists among them. There was a greater social acceptability. And so therefore we should, like, weight those things differently. This is a messy thing that I'm sure I'm going to get reader notes for. But what I'm trying to say is it unfair for us to evaluate presidents with the 2020 hindsight vision of history?
My answer to that is I think that's the beginning of the conversation, not the end.
Yeah.
Where typically, like, that's sort of where it goes, is like, well, we, you know, things have changed.
Which is why Wilson is dropping and things like that.
Yeah, I think
and
so.
Bill.
And Jackson.
Clinton.
Yeah, and Bill.
Yeah. I also think that this applies very specifically to certain presidents, and that especially Washington and Jefferson have this sort of moat around them of opinion where people don't even ask those questions, much less come up with satisfying answers to them.
Right.
I think you should absolutely grade with a modern understanding of morality. I mean, what's the point of progressing as a species if you're not going to...
Sure, but I guess my devil's advocate thing would be, like, for Washington and Jefferson, their slave ownership wasn't a campaign issue, like a front and center campaign issue, was it?
No, I get, but no. But it's not like there weren't people at,
opposed to it, of course.
Right.
Of course.
Who called it, you know, who knew it was immoral. What I mean is, like, to pretend, look, these type of rankings are political and they're subjective, and to pretend otherwise, you know, this isn't Mount Rushmore. And so the fact that they are subjective and political,
some of what my argument is trying to get at is, like, well, the Romans owned slaves, therefore should we condemn Roman civilization, and, like, you know, Greeks had slaves, should we condemn democracy as a ultimately, you know, foundationally corrupt institution? I'm doing a little bit of devil's advocate.
I know.
Because it's sort of like, well, I personally believe in not an evolution of individual morality, but as societies progress and evolve, there's greater building of empathy, and which is what I think, you know, now not only do most people see slavery as a completely morally bankrupt system, but they're starting to see, you see this in the past 2 years where people are seeing, whoa, that was implicit bias, or this is implicit bias. You see a greater evolution of maybe not morality, but empathy, which I do think spins into a different codification of morality. And that's kind of my argument of, like, I'm not saying I necessarily believe this outright, but I am a little bit like, well, is it fair to totally turn our modern eye in judgment?
So I guess what I'd say is the question of how we should celebrate someone like, for example, George Washington, celebrate what he contributed to the world while also taking into account failings on his part.
Yeah.
That is a complicated question.
Yeah.
But as Julia pointed out in her piece, the conversation is so weighted towards just overlooking those failings,
particularly
on race,
that,
like, I'm going to wait a little bit before I really worry about waiting and paying too much attention to those failings.
Yeah.
Julia, this sort of ties back into something that is in these rankings, because we don't see a lot of changes in the rankings about sort of presidents, you know, like Washington and from a long time ago. The presidents who have seemed to have shifted the most number of spaces in the last 4 years are more recent. So Bill Clinton saw a decline. Obama got a big boost. George W. Bush is up 5 places to number 35. Is it just a recency bias? We sort of are doing more thinking about the most recent presidents, or is there something going on there that, you know, most of the shifting has happened with the last few presidents?
I think what's interesting about that is it shows the shifting, like, stories about them as the stories are being told, right? So, like, we kind of know the story with Washington and Jefferson, and, you know, regardless of where people fall on that, there's been sort of, I don't want to say there's been a consensus to ignore slavery, not to open this back up, but that there kind of, like, clearly has been, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with Bush, I think people are having, like, Bush is, I think, an interesting example, because presidency experts seem to be having this kind of big discussion, and people, journalists and politically attentive citizens, all having this big conversation about George W. Bush, the impact of some of the policies he had that were very unpopular by the time he left office, and then also some of the ways in which he is now being perceived as having respected democratic norms and legitimate opposition. And so we're sort of seeing this, like, the shifting of the story. And I think that's really what, this sort of my theory about how this all works is, like, the story gets written over time and gets written by a variety of actors who are competing to figure out which considerations are going to matter the most and what aspects of the presidency are going to be emphasized the most in that. In that story, one thing I think we don't really know as people who study politics or presidents in one way or another is actually the kind of process by which that happens. So modern presidents and some before that have foundations that are people who are tasked with shaping how the public views the legacy of those presidents and, like, puts together the museum. Yeah, there's a ton of drama around the Nixon Library and Museum and the Nixon Foundation. And they do things like they raise money to bring people like me to do research in the archives, which raises the profile of what, you know, what those presidents did in scholarly circles, where there's only 100 of us and we all know each other. But the you know, you see that kind of thing, like, you know, how do parties have an incentive to emphasize certain legacies and not others, stuff like that. Like, you see a lot of talk in the 2016 primary debates, you would see a lot of mentions of Reagan, not so many mentions of George W. Bush. That's obvious, but, like, that kind of thing, I think we don't know a lot about how those legacies get propagated in the, like, a couple decades after someone leaves office.
But, Julia, you wrote in your piece today that these rankings really sort of tell you more about the current moment than maybe they do about history. And you can completely see that in how these people have moved around, right? So, like,
Bush is so interesting.
G.W. Bush, Trump is like the best thing that ever happened to Bush's legacy. You know, he goes up five spots just because he was, I think, the last Republican to respect Democratic norms. Bill Clinton drops five positions. Why? Because the national psyche now is much less forgiving of sexual misconduct, right? And then Obama goes up 10 points, I think, just because, you know, his term ended. And so it's like, you know, I think we should look at these as like a reflection of our current state. I do think the people who do these need to just find some more Republican-leaning poli-sci professors.
So can we ask about that? So Julia, this survey does, in a way, account for partisanship, right? It asks, so there's no expectation that if you are a poli-sci professor, you are supposed to be just sit back and be able to make a fair judgment. We should sort of take partisanship into account here?
I mean, you have it in the survey for you, yeah. I think if you asked a bunch of political science professors what do you perceive the norms in our profession about political activity to be, you would get a lot of different answers.
Let's not ask that.
Yeah. Maybe not. But yeah, I do think that I will say that presidency scholars do place a strong value on trying to assess presidents according to some kind of criteria that they think are important. But of course, how they think about those criteria is, I think, partly also going to be shaped by partisanship.
Do you guys think including Trump is just crazy?
It feels a little unfair.
It feels a little strange and potentially a little trolly. Not to give B&J a hard time. I'm now on first initial
friend
basis
of the,
with
friend
them.
Of the show, B&J, yeah.
But you know, just, I don't know.
Julia?
I think it made total sense to include Trump, and nobody said anything when they included Obama in the first one. And that was the big finding from the first one. I should also say I participated in the first one, but I didn't participate in the second one. The first one, the whole headline that came out of that, which was interesting, was that scholars thought Obama was kind of overrated. Because I think at that point, you know, political scientists, we do kind of, I think, like to be a little bit contrarian at times. And I think people thought, you know, Obama's getting all this hype. But in fact, from, you know, looking at a lot of standard ways of measuring a presidency, maybe he hasn't done everything that he could have. And so that was the big headline out of the first one. Admittedly, that was well into Obama's term, but nobody really, I don't think anybody raised this complaint in any prominent way. I think it's totally fine to include Trump as long as we're all honest about, you know, when the survey was taken.
I feel like sitting president, I mean, maybe this is, I'm not a political scientist, so maybe, as you said, maybe it should be, we should have all the data points that we can. But, you know, to me, I'm like, well, maybe it shouldn't be a sitting president because you can't have the full scope of their presidency, which it seems like everyone else has the benefit mm-hmm. of having scholars assess the full scope of their presidency. And in some ways, it feels like we're just asking scholars what their current political views are.
And since no one will be able to check, I actually do remember having a problem with this when it happened with Obama. And you just have to take my word for it. But I totally objected. Just I didn't have a podcast at the time, so no one knows. Julia, let me ask you one final question here, which is, this is a survey of presidential scholars. Do we know at all whether this squares with the public? If you polled all Americans and asked them to rank all the presidents, would they come up with a similar ranking?
I think this was pretty similar. They had reported a lot. They reported much more extensively on that in the 2014 ones, and they really emphasized like who experts think are better and worse than the general public does. There's an interesting. I don't know off the top of my head every survey, but my sense having looked at this data is it's not way off. I think what's interesting about that is you might expect that if you're being asked on the phone to rank presidents, the public ones are almost always only modern presidents. You might just kind of go with your partisanship because that's a very useful shortcut. Yeah. But the more we know, one thing we know in poli-sci is the more people know about politics and the more invested they are in it, the more likely they are to be partisan. And that may be no less true of experts than it is of non-experts.
Here, you've asked people, who is the best president in U.S. history?
Can we guess?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Claire, do you want to guess here?
So there's I think it was the guy from Independence Day. Yes,
they asked this in 2018.
Bill Pullman.
Bill Pullman.
Yeah.
Why was Bill Pullman never like a leading man?
He was the president
but
of
Independence
Day.
But he wasn't like the leading man. He was just overshadowed
Will
by
Smith
Tom.
Smith was the leading man.
Tommy Lee Jones should have played the president at some point. Continue, sorry.
No, the question actually, believe it or not, was for you. guess who was number one?
I'm supposed to guess?
YouGov asked, who is the best president in U.S. history? I'll give you a hint.
Lincoln.
There's a two-way tie for
Lincoln and
first
Washington.
Place.
Yeah, that's obvious.
Lincoln and Washington.
Jody?
Lincoln and Washington.
Lincoln and Washington.
Hayes and Arthur.
You're all wrong.
What?
And you're all 100% wrong.
Millard Fillmore.
Reagan and Obama.
Exactly.
Oh yeah! Wow. I am the voice of the people.
All right. So
Julia's point is really right.
It's
which
modern,
is that
right.
That it's modern and it's heavily partisan, right? Because so, if you just say, who are the patron saints of the two halves of our country, it's Reagan and Washington, and boom, those are your answers. Reagan and Obama. And
so 16% said Reagan, 16% said Obama. Who's number three?
Gotta Jody, be Lincoln.
Don't look at
it's
my clean.
I'm not looking. It's got to be Lincoln.
Claire?
FDR?
Remember, this is
Julia.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Lincoln, 15%. Number four, two-way tie for 10%.
Only 40 more presidents to go, guys. We can get through this.
All right, so then it's...
What's Lincoln?
Rattle them off. We got to end
George the show. Washington, FDR, both with 10%, right? JFK with 9%.
Nah.
Bill Clinton with 5%.
Wow. Okay.
Donald Trump with 5%. So it's like, you know, people, I think these are the basically list of the presidents people can remember.
Yeah. That's fair.
All right. Well, that's very interesting. So, Michael, will you tweet that out later for people to see that YouGov poll?
No.
Tough but fair.
Totally nuts. Can I tweet that?
Freaking yes. Google it, people. Okay.
Jeez. Okay. We are going to end it there. Julia Azari, thanks for joining us. And you can read her piece on all of this on the site right now. It just went up this morning.
538.com. All spelled out.
All spelled out. No numbers.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Julia was like, oh.
I think she set the record for fastest leaving by a guest. Claire Malone, thanks to you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Micah Cohen, thank you.
You're also welcome.
Okay, appreciate it. I feel very well loved. My name is Jody Avigan. Gillendruck is our producer, and Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch. Email us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon. All right, listeners, if you're still listening, thank you. And here is the Curling Podcast, as promised, a little excerpt of it. You can find the full thing in the feed for The Lab, which is 538's NBA podcast, which you should be listening to anyway, but they did a curling special. You can go find it. But anyway, here's a quick taste of the Curling Podcast that we promised.
I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, is there like curling win percentage? Did you guys have a sense when you were, I think, 2-4, did you have a sense for like what the chances were and how difficult that was? Or did you not think about it that much?
We're looking at that stuff all the time just because, you know, you want to know if you're still in the tournament or not. But we're usually taking it game by game. As long as we know we're still alive, we're going to play every bit as hard, even if we're eliminated. But we looked at the other teams ahead of us, who they played and everything like that. We mapped it out, and we knew we were still alive. And we also look at our winning percentages against other teams, too, just because going into the tournament, we knew that we had a good record against basically every team. I think Scotland was the only team that had a winning record against us over the last 2 years. So, I mean, going into the tournament, we felt confident against about every team we played, and the Swedes in particular, too. I mean, everybody talks about the monumental upset in the last game. Well, the last 6 times we played those guys, we beat them 5. So, I mean, it's a matchup thing for us, too. And, you know, we don't mind people thinking that it was a big upset. It's a better story that way. But, you know, we beat Canada 3 times in a row. We beat the Swedes 5 out of 6. Sometimes it's just matchups as good as anything else.
Yeah, that was 3 in a row against the Cruz, too, right?
Against, 3 in a row against the Swiss guys, too. So.
We actually got two separate invites in the last week after I wrote the story about the popularity during the Olympics to go to curling clubs. I think one was in New Jersey. I'm not sure where the other one was. So I was going to ask, what would your advice be to a first-time curler taking the ice for the first time?
My best advice would be don't fall.
Go well, they've got shoes for that, right? The one shoe, at least, for that.
You know, they do, but my first game at the Olympics, I fell.
Oh, yeah, like, yeah, so I really saw that.
People fall.
Down goes Hamilton.
Don't go down. It's still hard ice. But in seriousness, if you go in with an open mind and are really, like, curious about the sport itself, like, not just the throwing aspect, but, like, actually, like, kind of immersing yourself in what curling's about, and you find all the, like, these people that are so willing to help and teach and really get you into the strategy, which really, that's the draw. Like, speaking for myself, but I'm sure a lot of the guys here would agree, like, making shots is great, and that it felt good when you made your first couple shots in curling when you've tried it, but, like, when you finally learn why you're throwing that shot and why making that shot set you up later in that end and later in that game to win, it's really just a remarkable feeling. It really is like chess on ice. And it just kind of that like mental game mixed with a finesse game mixed with, you know, brute force of sweeping. Like it really has all the aspects of a really like fun game.